You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Living among human beings gives an observant person plenty of occasions to think about delusion. Whether one watches the young revolutionary or the aging politician, the conspiracy theorist or the devotee of conventional wisdom, human beings take a peculiar joy in fooling ourselves. And we don't have to limit ourselves to a single explanation of delusion either. Calvin's Workshop for Idols and Nietzsche's Clever Forgetting Ape both make good sense, depending on whom one watches and in which moment. One could even imagine someone wondering, and forgiving the gendered language of the moment, what a piece of work is man? And if that last one rings true, you're already geared up to hear about Shakespeare's exploration of human delusion, specifically in his tragedies. Roderick Lewis's recent book, Shakespeare's Tragic Art, puts delusion in the center of the conversation, and Christian Humanist Profiles, with a very clear mind indeed, is glad to welcome him to the show. Rodri, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Seth. It's a real pleasure to be here, Nathan.
I want to lead off, as your book's introduction does, by acknowledging a long history of writers who try to say what tragedy is and what tragedy does, and then attempting to improve on what's come before. So Aristotle presents Athenian tragedy as civic gathering that inspires fear and pity. Friedrich Nietzsche sees the same tragedies as contests of psychological order and chaos. And Alistair MacIntyre sees all kinds of tragedy as staging competing demands of goodness and justice. Your account of Shakespeare's tragedy focuses on delusion as a driving force. As we make our way through Shakespeare's plays, what kinds of things will we understand focusing on delusion that we might miss if we don't?
That's a really great opening question. Thanks. I guess I've got two answers to that, one of which is sort of a little bit superficial, and I'll go with that one first, and then I'll go with the longer and I think more interesting answer second. I mean, the superficial one is that delusion enables us to see slightly more than would otherwise be the case over the ways in which Shakespeare sort of begins writing tragedy, which is to say we're quite used to when we are looking at comedy as a genre in general, but also Shakespearean comedy, looking at the delusions of lovers. And part of the humour of the comedies is that, you know, when you're young and in love, you say and do stupid things to yourself, to those around you, to what have you. But it's a comedy, so there's a sort of, there's enough of a supervening moral, social, emotional, aesthetic order enabled to, so that, you know, by the end of the play, harmony breaks out, despite the delusions of the young lovers, such as they are, and perhaps their parents sometimes as well. So, you know, harmonic order can be restored. What I think Shakespeare starts to get interested in, really interested in by the mid sort of 1590s, around the time he's writing Romeo and Juliet, but arguably earlier, is, you know, what if those delusions can't? What if there's no framework of morality or a social order or whatever it might be that enable us to bring about harmony? And I think delusion then becomes the sort of, he gets really hung up on this, and it becomes the, you know, the hook on which he hangs lots, I think, of his tragic experiments. As I call them experiments, because I think he never really settles on a you know, a theory or a model or something like that of what tragedy ought to do. But here I sort of segue into the second answer, the more interesting one. I mean, I think in a sense, delusion is a secondary phenomenon within the tragedies, because I think what Shakespeare is really interested in is our hunger for, you know, self-understanding, for the security that comes from self-understanding, from having a handle on who and what we are, why we're here, what makes us distinctive, how we can live meaningful, full, rewarding lives. And I think one of the things the tragedies, perhaps, well, for me anyway, the thing in which the tragedies are preoccupied is the problem that we don't really have hard and fast answers to that question. or that hard and fast answers to that question are very, 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 very difficult to come by. And so, because we are hungry for the security of self-understanding, of meaning, of these sorts of things, and because we are quite clever as creatures, we come up with theories, with stories, with philosophies, with slightly more controversially, and Shakespeare stays away from this for reasons we can come back to, from to religions, as a way to give an account of, you know, who and what we are and why we matter. And I think one of the things he does in his Tragic Protagonists, and this is, I promise I'm going to circle back to delusion in a second, is this idea of, you know, the delusion, the not just fictions, but the delusions by which we govern ourselves. So we tie ourselves up, or he has his characters, his protagonists, tie themselves up to ideas of nature, to ideas of social order, to ideas of family, to ideas of honor, this, that, and the other, which all of which enable them to tell themselves that they make sense, that they have that security, that they are able to, you know, ground themselves meaningfully within the sort of curious experience of being a sort of intelligent, self-conscious force on Earth, as we all are, but end up telling stories that alienate themselves from themselves. And so tragedy comes from, you know, the collision between his protagonists as they would like to be, or would like to think of themselves as cohering, and, you know, dramatic reality as Shakespeare sort of forces them to confront. And it's really interesting that you mentioned Aristotle, Nietzsche, and McIntyre, because, I mean, Aristotle's an interesting case. I'll stick with him to begin with, because it's not entirely...
A careful reader of Shakespeare, Aristotle was.
Absolutely. Devoted. I think they'd have got on, actually, but, you know, that's a separate question. You know, it's unclear, really, whether we think Aristotle has tragedy as something that teaches civic virtue, or, you know, it's a sort of handmaiden to the Nicomachean Ethics, say, or whether, and it's kind of where I am, is closer to this, the sort of Martha Nussbaum version of Aristotle's Poetics, where it actually gives us a space in which we are able to sort of confront the reality of being, you know, intelligent, morally preoccupied beings who are nevertheless animals that are forced to think and feel through their emotions, such that the kinds of knowledge you can get as that kind of creature are not the absolute models of the kind that many people have sought over the years. And so tragedy is a kind of space in which you're able to explore yourself as an inherently emotional thinking creature. And I think that appeals to Shakespeare very much. And so instead of, you know, say, calling people delusional because they haven't realized the truth of one philosophy or another, I think Shakespeare is sort of encouraging us. Well, I mean, and here I kind of go away from what I'm certain of to my interpretation, I suppose. He is encouraging us to find ways of coming to terms with the reality of being beings who don't have absolute knowledge, can't have absolute knowledge, are cut off from a sense of a complete sense of who and what they are. And so here, I suppose, I think that Shakespeare, the tragedian, differs from someone like McIntyre, for whom tragedy is what happens when you don't have a proper sense of virtue ethics, when you don't have that sense of being connected to, you know, broader truths, be they social or philosophical or theological or whatever it happens to be. And, you know, tragedy is a good example of why we need to work towards those sorts of things for McIntyre. Whereas for Shakespeare, I think it's kind of more of a, well, you know, we have to find a way of... dealing with the fact that we are not equipped to understand, you know, the biggest questions of why and how. And, you know, this is, were Shakespeare here, he would say, well, I'm a playwright, and I hand those questions over to my friends in the Church of England, whose conclusions I support wholeheartedly as an obedient Anglican. And, you know, we couldn't second guess that. But yeah, it's a very different way of writing tragedy, I think, than the sort of more conventionally moralized Aristotle, and the kind of thing that MacIntyre sees tragedy as pointing us towards as well. Sorry, that was a very long and recursive answer. I hope it got to.
No, it was a good answer, and I read MacIntyre somewhat differently. But we're here to talk about your book, not about MacIntyre. Oh, so we're gonna forge ahead because that was a good framework, and I want to add one more dimension to it, and that is the dimension of suffering. When you write about the suffering in Shakespeare's tragedies, you say that suffering is both universal and contingent.
Yeah.
So why are both of those predicates important? And as we start looking for both of them in the plays, what does each add to our project?
Yeah, that's a great question. I suppose what I mean by that is simply the kind of suffering. Well, there's also different kinds of suffering. The sufferings in which I think Shakespeare in the tragedies is interested is the suffering that comes from the collision between our senses of ourself as we want to be, as we want to see ourselves, and the kinds of sort of dramatic realities with which he makes those senses of self collide, if that makes sense. And one of the things that Shakespeare, I think, is really interested in doing is, you know, saying that tragic order, say, the order of a tragic plot, if you are either Aristotle or if you are a Christian Aristotelian, of whom there were very many in the century before Shakespeare wrote, is to say that, you know, tragic plot actually mirrors providence in some way or other. You know, the way in which things happen in the world follows a divinely sanctioned order, just as the way in which things, the things that happen in a tragedy follow the poetic, dramatic order imposed by the playwright. Shakespeare, I think, is interested in the idea that, in fact, lots of the things that give us most headaches and most pain and most suffering in our lives are not, obviously, ordained or orderly, or in any sense comprehensible, actually. And he feels, I think, that traditional tragedy, at least tragedy as written on the traditional Aristotelian lines, actually fudges something really important by saying that, you know, a tragic plot has to be arranged according to the principles of probability and necessity, not arbitrariness or randomness. Whereas for Shakespeare, you know, oftentimes it's something. I mean, the sort of standout example would be, and I know we're going to come back to Romeo and Juliet later. Romeo and Juliet is really a kind of dark. It's shaping up to be a dark comedy along the lines of, I don't know, Much Ado About Nothing or something like that. And then a letter.
I always used to teach those two plays as a pair when I taught Shakespeare in college. Yep.
Until a letter goes astray during a plague lockdown. The letter goes astray and tragedy becomes inevitable. I mean, that's not what's supposed to happen. Or to take another example from Othello, because it's one that everyone got very worked up about in the 18th century. You know, this is another kind of dark love comedy. Until the handkerchief gets lost. And there's a famous critic of Shakespeare, a man called Thomas Rymer from the late 17th century, who just kind of tears his hair out at Othello, saying, you know, what's the lesson in this play? Is it that young women should be more careful with their laundry, with their linen? That's the only lesson I can take from this. And I think Shakespeare's point is, again, those kind of little arbitrary, very contingent acts, these are the kind of the stuff of Shakespearean tragedy, no pun intended, as it were, with stuff and linen. are not the big kind of tragic inevitabilities with which, you know, we are used at high school and in our, you know, and I wrote my share of these essays to dealing with this idea of, you know, big archetypal characters colliding with the force that's beyond their control because they are the creatures of the gods and such. That, I think, interests Shakespeare's imagination much less than the way in which, you know, the way in which it is to live in history with things just happening around you that you don't understand, but that you need to process in real time and that you very often get wrong because, you know, we all do.
Sure, sure. We're going to shift our focus now and start talking about particular plays. And I want our listeners to know that the treasure in this book comes from the close examination of the plays that you do along with Dr. Lewis. So we're going to sample what's good here, but you really need to go out and read this book to get all of the good stuff. So here's the first sample. The prologue to Romeo and Juliet has convinced generations of ninth graders, and I was one of them, that this is a play about inescapable fate, like you just said. But the play itself is more about, and this is why we talked about this in broad terms before we got to the individual plays, turn after turn in which human responses to events and then events that elude human agency really do make differences. So talk to us about this experiment with misdirecting an audience with a prologue.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, Romeo and Juliet's an old story, like a lot of early Shakespeare, a lot of early and late Shakespeare. He takes an established story, and it's a morality story about why you need to listen to your parents. And also why you shouldn't listen to mendicant friars, because, you know, it's all about bad things will happen if you do young love and follow your passions and all the rest of it. And so the version of that story with which he was working is shaped like that. And Shakespeare, and also begins with a sonnet, like Shakespeare begins his play with that prologue sonnet describing what's going to happen. And it's a beautiful model of, as you say, tragic inevitability, you know, good learnings, so to speak, for the perhaps, you know, amorously minded young readers or viewers of the play. But then we get into the play itself, and it sets up completely differently. As I said, you know, you go all the way through, really, until the point at which Romeo accidentally kills Tybalt, and then really only until the letter goes astray. You don't actually know that you are stuck in this weird you know, play, which is a tragedy of accidents, of bad timing, of things going wrong. I've talked about that a little bit already, but you asked about the experiment of misdirection. I think he's borrowing here from the Roman tradition, particularly a Roman playwright called Seneca, who would very often use a chorus to, you know, give us the appropriate Roman morality, as it were, draw the appropriate lessons, but in which the relationship between the frame, which is to say the choric material, the chorus, and the action is in sort of ironic relationship to one another. The frame sounds a little bit pat, a little bit too easy, a little bit too neat, undermined, if you like, by the energy, by the reality of what's going on there. And the purpose of that is to make Seneca's Roman listeners and readers think very hard about the kind of conventional morality and their position as spectators and readers of such conventional moralities. And I think that's what Shakespeare is doing here. Also having fun. I mean, he's, you know, this is second tragedy he writes, 1595-ish. He's not quite worked out how to do tragedy yet, but he knows what he doesn't want to do, and he doesn't want to do conventional stuff. And so this is a fun little bit of formal experimentation, and it's, you know, it's important to us, I think, as you know, readers and teachers and, you know, lovers of Shakespeare now, to see, you know, it's a sort of really very advanced apprentice piece, because we can see some of the techniques that he will employ to, you know, even more astonishing effect over the next sort of decade and a half from here. In embryonic form is kind of patronizing, and I don't want to patronize him, because Romeo and Juliet's a beautiful play, but it's you know, it's there in an early
compared to Lear.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That makes good sense. Well, sticking with the early tragedies, talk with us a moment about hunting rituals. This was something that you examined that I'd really never thought about in Julius Caesar. What kind of irony are we seeing emerge in this early Roman play?
Yeah, that's a great question again. I mean, I wrote a book on Hamlet came out in 2017, called Hamlet and the Vision of Darkness. And I became obsessed with the language and assumptions of hunting as they keep coming up in that play. And I won't go into that now. So they were in my head anyway. And after Brutus and the conspirators have killed Caesar, quite early on in the action, actually, of Julius Caesar, they start talking about, you know, covering themselves in blood up to the arms. And it's a very strange, and Caesar's blood, you know, daubing themselves in it. And it's a very strange piece of language. But it's language borrowed from hunting. Once you've killed a deer in traditional hunting in the 16th and 17th centuries, it's supposed to be a kind of almost spiritual act. And so you cover yourself in the blood of the deer, and there's a whole range of iconographical things one can talk about there. But there's a sort of critique of that way of doing things, which comes from a work like, I don't know, Erasmus's Praise of Folly. And Erasmus, great Christian humanist, great hater of hunting. He says that, you know, we human beings should not be making ourselves into animals, because that's what we do when we go hunting. We are pursuing pleasure, and we're dressing it up as some kind of spiritual activity. And so that kind of rituals around hunting for Erasmus are delusion of the kind that we've talked about before. And Shakespeare, I think, is plugging into that way of doing things there, because the conspirators in Julius Caesar, yes, they are at some level legitimately worried that Caesar might become a tyrant and therefore cause problems. But really what they're doing is acting in the interests, to defend the interests of their sort of oligarchic class who have ruled Rome for a lengthy period of time. And there's, you know, all kinds of contemporary resonances there that we need to get into now. So they are, it's a way of magic, it's a form of magical thinking, saying we are doing this in a spiritual way. Shakespeare is saying, no, actually, I'm going to give you this hunting language as a way of tipping the wink to anyone who knows the way I think about these things, that in fact, you're kidding yourselves. You're doing this. Yes, there's a kind of principle at stake, but you're doing this from self-interest. You're doing this from, a desire to maintain your own place and status within the Roman Republic, and not have it taken over by a new man who's a populist. In a sense, Julius Caesar is really about Brutus, not about Julius Caesar, and about Brutus, and he never comes to terms with himself. I mean, he thinks he's acting from principle, but actually, because he has this sense of who and what he is as a perfect Roman, but is in fact acting from a range of rather complicated emotions and desires and fears.
Well, so return to that animal language. In Brutus's famous speech before the conspirators arrive at his home, he uses some animal language, but not animals I usually associate with hunting. It's serpent language. It is dragon language. Yeah. Is there a link there, or I mean, are those entirely different animal constellations?
I mean, you know, it's serpents, dragons. They're all seen as, in some sense, outside the order of things. They are monsters of one kind or another, largely because, you know, Western Europe at that time doesn't really have much knowledge of large numbers of these animals, and so they're outside. And snakes, obviously, even without, and the Romans don't obviously have access to Hebraic and Christian tradition, but serpents always get a bad press. In some sense or another. And that's a fascinating, I mean, I love that speech, just that turns on that moment, fashion it thus, you know.
Absolutely.
I can't prove it. No, he hasn't done anything wrong. Yes, he's feeble. Yes, he's epileptic. Yes, he's a bad swimmer. Yes, he's... But. What if? And, you know, because he needs to tell himself that he's actually taking out, you know, taking out a legitimate threat rather than, as perhaps someone like Cassio would be happy to admit, his collaborator, you know, we're doing this because if we don't, you know, us and our fellow oligarchs are not going to be in charge.
Right.
So, delusion
really surfaces for me in your examination of Hamlet. So we're talking about the young Dane's epistemological delusion, to be sure. But really, it's the audience's delusion that caught my attention.
Yeah.
So, Rodri, I need to do some psychology on me here. Why have I always thought that I knew why Claudius flees from the play? And why have I never really slowed down to ask whether or not the young Hamlet actually believes the apparition of his father?
Well, because we're caught up in many things in Hamlet. One of them is a revenge play, and we are used to what's supposed to be happening. You know, we were talking a little bit about that the beginning of the misdirection at the beginning of Romeo and Juliet. I think the same thing is happening here. This is shaped like a Senecan revenge play, and we all know what's supposed to happen. You know, dude is guilty. Revenger has to grapple with the fact that he, or sometimes she, is going to have to, you know, break the moral code to assuage feelings of rage or a kind of unsatisfied justice or something or other. And then that happens, and then everyone has to die at the end because, you know, the bad guy is the bad guy. And the revenger has to die because he's broken the law as well. Or broken the moral code, and somehow or other the order gets restored at the end. And we are carried along with that kind of superficial plotting form. We know it so well, so instinctively. I think Shakespeare is you know, pulling at the threads of that weave the whole way through and inviting us to do the same sorts of thing. Because we are caught up, you know, we want to identify with Hamlet and we want to think, you know, that, you know, he's a good guy and is, you know, well, as it were, on the side of the angels, albeit conflictedly and complicatedly at times. And so we don't pay attention.
What strikes me... I'll go ahead. What strikes me is that I have, when I've taught Hamlet in the past, I have focused on that line where he says, even if this is a devil in the shape of my father, still I will get my revenge. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but I had always taught it as a sort of hyperbolic rhetorical flourish. You brought to my attention, that's not anything that the play presents with any kind of solidity.
No. Exactly. And I mean, you know, you have to imagine yourself going back to that, you know, why don't we, at the Claudius fleeing, why don't we normally think about why that's... Put yourself in the position of anybody else in that court right there. All they see is, you know, their crazy young Nepo baby, very cross that he's not king because his dad did not nominate him heir, unlike his uncle, who's now in charge, who has nominated him heir, and who has staged this play in which he offers a fantasia of someone killing his uncle. You know, this is not good. And, you know, poor old Horatio, you know, has to be the bridge between Hamlet and the social reality he inhabits. And he says, did you not mark it? He's, yes, very well I did, my lord. You know, it's just like, you know, it's sort of being the counselor to someone who's unhinged. And so, It's really complicated, and I mean, the ghost is a perfect example, actually. I talk about this a little bit in the book. I mean, everyone sort of in 1599 or 1600 agrees what ghosts are, which is to say, they are, you know, disturbances in your mind, which is to say, there's no actual ghost just over there. It's a spirit that is making it look as if there is by acting on your imagination. And To go very, very crudely, there are three positions, one of which is Roman Catholic, one of which is more or less Protestant, one of which is more or less scientific. Roman Catholic one says that disturbance that's in your mind is either an angel, maybe, probably not, a demon, quite possibly, or more likely than not, somebody from purgatory, a spirit from purgatory coming back to talk to you and seek your intercession with the church or with good works or something so that time can be cut short. If you are a Protestant, you say it's an angel, maybe, but almost certainly not, or almost certainly a demon. So purgatory is cast aside as a sort of invention of the 13th century church, money-making wheeze that's turned into doctrine over the centuries. And if you're a modern guy, you say, actually, it's just what we would call, a delusionality. It's a phantasm. It is something. It's a mental disturbance in some way or another. So everybody sees exactly the same thing. Everybody thinks about exactly the same thing, which is to say something happening in your head. But they disagree fundamentally on what that thing is. So it's a thing, but no one can agree about its thinginess. The meta joke, as it were, is the one place in which ghosts are real is the theatre. And everyone knows what they are. And so for Shakespeare, the ghost becomes a way of dealing with this world in which, we all see the same things. More or less, but because we don't agree on what they mean, and we don't therefore experience the world in the same way, and it becomes incredibly difficult to find a way of connecting, to find a way of imposing order, to find a frame through which sense can be made of what's going on. And so instead of the kind of resolution you get at the end of a revenge tragedy where, yes, everyone's dead, but morality is restored, we get this thuggish Norwegian prince who happens to be marching by with his army and who comes in and takes over. And this is very hard, normally cut from production because it doesn't fit with our sense of what Hamlet ought to be doing, Hamlet the play ought to be doing. But I think very, very closely aligned to that Shakespearean habit of subversion, of misdirection, of, upending tragic expectations such that we in the audience think much harder about, how we are situated in relation to all these traditions.
Excellent, excellent. Now, listeners, I want to pause here for a moment to say that if you're listening to this and you say, Gilmore, you skipped my favorite tragedy, I apologize for that, but we have been an hour, so we've got to move fast. This is why you need to go out, get the book, read it, and then you will get Dr. Lewis's examination of your favorite tragedy, because they are all in here. England in Shakespeare's day, the literate class there in England, is in love with Cicero. They love the Romans. And one of the plays that calls into question some of the images of humanity that emerge from especially philosophers, but also from classical antiquity more generally, is Macbeth. That tragedy gives audiences an aspiring tyrant who quotes classical works to elude his own sense of responsibility, building on some of the things that you talked about with Julius Caesar, and who looks to the end of, quote, recorded time, unquote, as the sum of everything important. So, I mean, what kinds of things do literate London-going or London play-going people hear in Macbeth that maybe we don't hear in the 21st century?
That's a great question again. I'll do one quick superficial one again, and I'll give a sort of more interesting and complicated one to follow up. I mean, one of the things this is true, I suppose, of Othello as well, which we think was probably written just before, also true of Lear, maybe written just after, you talked about the Roman heritage, this idea of honestas, which, it's sort of the origin of our word honesty, obviously, but in Latin it actually means honor.
Iago.
Exactly. And the Iago straddles those two senses of it. Somebody who is superficially, honor is superficial, it is social, it is something we all look at and we recognize. Whereas honesty is something inner and is sort of vouchsafed either by conscience or by the relationship between an individual and God. That's obviously within the Christian tradition, not the secular Roman one. We could talk about Iago, but you asked me about Macbeth, so I'll go with that. I mean, you know, kings and the ruling class are all, you know, sort of by definition honorable, invested with honestas. And that is supposed to be its own reward, at least within the sort of political, social ideology of the age. And this is why I say it's a basic answer. And obviously, in Macbeth, we have somebody who fits all of those things. He is a perfect warrior princeling who goes on, initially at least, to be quite an effective warrior, handsome, you know, philosopher king in some sense or another. And we know that's not true, because we see some, so there's already a kind of disconnection between the appearance of a king and the kind of psychological, moral, political reality that's sort of underpinning it. And, you know, there's a whole sort of backstory there which one can trace through the history plays about Machiavellianism and blah, blah, blah. Needn't do that now. What's more interesting, I think, about Macbeth is the model of, if you like, divine right kingship, which is to say hereditary kingship of a kind that is touched by God, such that, you know, in the model of Christian kingship that develops over the Middle Ages, and the king of England at the time, he'd formerly been King James VI of Scotland, he still was King James VI of Scotland, but he was also now King James I of England, was very devoted to this divine right ideology. And the model of that is two bodies. Which is to say, a king has a body natural, which is the body that you and I and everybody else have, and dies at some point after three score years and ten or whatever it might be. But more importantly,
Psalm 90, listeners.
Indeed, he has a body. He has a body mystical, a body politic, which never dies. And that is, it's divine, it lives outside of time, and whoever happens to be the monarch assumes at the moment of coronation, you know, when all the anointed oils and all the rest of it, that ceremony happens, the body politic, the body mystical, comes down into there. And so one of the things that Macbeth, the character, is really interested in obtaining, just like the guy who replaces him, Malcolm, at the end, is the kind of the existential anchor that a king can have by virtue of the body politic, the body mystical, the body however many different ways of describing it. Corpus mysticum, I suppose, is probably the shortest way of categorizing it, and that lives out of historical time. And is not subject to decay in the way of what's going on there. So this is kind of, you know, as it were, kingship 101. And Macbeth the play leads us to ask, I think, some really very fundamental questions about that as a kind of delusionality, a kind of coping mechanism, a sort of make-believe, so that we subjects can tell ourselves that our rulers, you know, are operating through God's say-so and with his ordination, but also so that those leaders can, you know, find some more stable basis from which to rule. And I think, you know, because Macbeth obtains this, I mean, you know, he is a legitimately enthroned monarch. I mean, no one knows how he got there, but the actual ceremony happens, and that ought to be enough, at least on some models of this thing. It doesn't work. He is more and more empty, more and more concerned. He gets there, he gets what he wants, and yet, you know, it's unsatisfying, it's unrewarding, it's ultimately, as he says, meaningless. And it's a really, I mean, Shakespeare had to be very careful, because, you know, you have your Scottish king who's been on the throne for a year and a half, maybe 2 years. And, you know, if you're writing a play about a Scottish monarch who's, you know, who's deposed by another Scottish monarch working in alliance with the English king, Edward the Confessor, who lends him troops. It's, you've got to tread very carefully, and Shakespeare does. And quite often Macbeth gets a bad press for being sort of Stuart propaganda. But here's where I would have to say to anyone, and I have said to people that say this, you know, you need to read more closely, because yes, it is superficially of a kind, written, you know, in a way that will appeal to the sort of Jacobean Stuart ideology as it's beginning to emerge in 1605. But look a little bit more closely, and you know, this is extremely subversive, and I'm pretty sure, I mean, I have no evidence for this, but I'm pretty sure that some members of that audience who are looking at Macbeth, you know, for the first time, must be noticing this. Because
I've got a question about one detail, and whether it would be something people would have noticed, and that is the fact that Fleance exits the play, and there's no explanation of how his descendants become king.
Yep.
So, I mean, you know, if it is bad for Macbeth to usurp a hereditary royal line, why is it not bad for Fleance to do so? You know, it seems like another place where the Stuarts would at least find this play a little bit troubling.
Yeah. No, I think Shakespeare just decides, I'm not going there. I'm going to leave this alone. I mean, there's another great place when Macbeth goes to the Weird Sisters the second time, and they're, you know, they call up the pageant of Banquo's descendants becoming king, and which is, you know, not quite accurate really, because there's a whole but leave that aside. The last one ought to have been Mary, Queen of Scots. But because no one wants to be reminded of her, certainly not James, and certainly not the English who'd killed her 20 years earlier, that lost monarch is a king. And it's just you know, historical airbrushing, you know, like one of those Stalinist photographs, you know, where the bad guy gets painted out, or the deposed guy gets painted out, and we pretend he wasn't there. Exactly what goes on, and you know, I can't blame Shakespeare for that. I mean, you know, why court trouble? You're subversive enough with what you're doing anyway,
and
questioning the ideology of kingship. As something that is, you know, at best a form of make-believe, and at worst something that is, you know, another of those delusions through which we alienate ourselves from who and what we really are. But anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, up to this point, Rodri, I've been praising your book for drawing to my attention things that normally I ignore in these plays, even though I teach them with some frequency. This one, though, I still don't get, and I need you to explain it to me. When you turn to King Lear, you make an early comment that, quote, and I quote Lewis here, Lear's plan is not obviously foolish, end quote. What is the logical merit of Lear's opening scene? And what about the play makes me want to call it obviously foolish? What's my delusion here, Rodri?
Well, we know what happens next. So, you know, it does not go well. But, I mean, you know, put yourself in Lear's position at the beginning of the play. You're 80 years old. You failed in your primary task as a king, which is to get yourself a son who can inherit the kingdom. You're going to die at some point quite soon because you're 80. And you want to prevent your kingdom from descending into civil war. So, you know, because that's what happens when you die without appropriate heirs. So you do the division already. You give the north of England to one daughter who's married to the Duke of Albany, i.e. the ruler of Scotland. You give the southwest to another daughter who's married to the Duke of Cornwall, ruler of the southwest, and you keep the really rich bit for your favourite daughter, Cordelia, where you propose to live. And, you know, you go through the motions of being extremely fair. And hopefully, you know, Cordelia will prevail in any future collisions. But, you know, you hope to forestall any future conflict. And, I mean, there's a good case in point, which, I mean, Shakespeare may or may not have known. I think he probably did. Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor, abdicates in, I'm making the date up slightly, but 1548 sticks in my head, give or take around there, and goes off to live in a monastery in the mountains of Spain, giving Spain And the Spanish territories to his son, and who becomes Philip II, you know, great friend of the English, and giving the Habsburg territories, what we think of now as Austria-Hungary, Burgundy, all those sorts of things, to his brother, dividing the kingdom, dividing his territories in a way that would, hope to forestall any future conflict. So Leah, the idea is not obviously bonkers. In my view, it goes horribly wrong because of the nature of Goneril and Regan, I think, and particularly the nature of Cornwall, to whom one of them is married. It goes wrong because Cordelia doesn't get what's happening. That, when the love contest is called, she doesn't realize this is not actually a test about love. This is just a piece of courtly maneuvering, and she can't play. And it goes wrong because when she can't play, Lear doesn't understand that she's doing this because she's vulnerable and a bit clueless. He feels out of her depth. He sees her as, trying to spite him in some way or another. And then, from there onwards, it does go wrong. I mean, yes. With the division plan, the initial division plan, there may have been some conflict, but not tragedy.
That makes some sense.
But he's in a horrible position because, divine right monarchy, if you don't have a son to inherit, you have a huge problem. And that is Leah's problem at the beginning of the play.
Since we have been talking about subversive Shakespeare, I've got a question that occurred to me as we were talking here, and it's something that has troubled me when I've taught this play, and I've never found an answer that satisfies me. But in this play, at least when I read it and when I've taught it, this play gets us rooting for the French invaders against England at the end. Is this something that folks in Shakespeare's day would have seen as subversive, or is this something that only occurs to latter-day readers?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that he Shakespeare very carefully makes sure that the King of France is not there on the ground leading his troops. He delegates, strangely absent as a whole, actually, delegates it all to his warrior wife, who, when we last saw her, was apparently not quite ready for this role, and probably not quite ready. They lose ultimately, so I don't know. But I don't think. I mean, it's an old story, right? I mean, which is to say, it's from Geoffrey of Monmouth originally, and so these details are there. I don't think that's seen as particularly subversive at this point. What is subversive, though, is that all those who know the story. And there had been a semi-popular King Lear play performed a little bit beforehand. And as I say, it's in Holinshed, it's in Geoffrey of Monmouth. People, Cordelia wins. The good guys win at the end, and Cordelia goes on to rule very happily for 20 years until the children of Goneril and Regan depose her and she kills herself. But so everyone, when they're watching this the first time, when they get to that, the reconciliation scene, the recognition and reconciliation scene where she says, if I'm not mistaken, I believe you to be my daughter Cordelia. It's all very touching. And, you think, well, hooray, we've got there. And then Shakespeare proceeds to beat you over the head and then rip out your heart with some very whatever thing. So I think the French stuff just goes by the by.
That's fascinating. Because honestly, I mean, I always put Lear next to the Henriette, Henry IV, Henry V, Henry VI, where France is the perennial adversary. And then we get to Lear and all of a sudden, we're rooting for Cordelia as she leads a presumably French army into England.
Yeah. Again, the Burgundians are normally the English allies against the French. As you were going back over the sort of the Hundred Years' War and that sort of period afterwards, because Burgundy just means all the territories all the way up to what's now Belgium and the Netherlands. I mean, that's all Burgundy at this point.
Okay, that makes sense. So I'm not dividing. I'm not dividing enough between the Burgundian and the Capetian French.
Yeah, it's not just kind of, you know, Dijon and some
right. Nice, that makes sense.
All the way up to.
Thank you for explaining that. Yeah. Now, before we turn to the late Roman plays, I want to pause and take stock of the plays that my own beloved Shakespeare professor at Milligan College called the Four Great Tragedies. as you present them, a common thread running through all four is that the main characters labor under delusions. And at least when I read or watch them, their delusions become mine in a lot of cases. If you would humor for a moment an interviewer who wrote his dissertation on Milton, how would you say that your thesis about Shakespeare's tragedies relates to Stanley Fish's about Paradise Lost? Is Shakespeare engaged in something like Milton's project of teaching readers to be suspicious of human reason, or is something else going on here?
That's a nice question again. I mean, you know, as somebody who...
It's a question from a Miltonist.
Yes, indeed. As somebody who cut his teeth being annoyed by Stanley Fish on Milton back in graduate school, I suppose it's not dissimilar to certain aspects of the Fish project or the Fish account of Milton in Surprised by Sin, which is to say, I think Shakespeare, yes. One of the reasons why he does the misdirection thing we've talked about a pile of times and subverts expectations is that he wants us to notice that what's actually happened is not what we think ought to have happened within a particular tragic model. And I think the reason for that, as I talk about a lot, is that he wants to get to, you know, he wants to get to catharsis, but a particular sense of catharsis, not in, you know, purgation in the traditional sense or purification, but a sort of mental clarification, an ability to see ourselves as rational beings, but as beings who are also inherently emotional. And the relationship between our emotions and our reason is what prevents us from getting absolute truth, absolute knowledge of who and what we are, and what also leads us to tell these stories that we're talking about as delusions in various different ways. So yes, I do think there's a certain similarity there. I mean, there's a difference there because I don't think that Fish's Milton does what Fish thinks Milton does. But I don't think that Shakespeare does either, if that makes sense, which is to say, I don't think Shakespeare is making a point. Certainly he's not making the point that Fish says Milton does, that, you know, we're all implicated in original sin and all those sorts of things. Maybe that's in the background there somewhere. I don't know. I don't have a window onto Shakespeare's religious soul, and I would not seek to open one, I suppose.
But I mean, are the scripts of the plays doing that? We do have access to those.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, they are certainly prompting us to, you know, think about who and what we are. That sense of who and what we are, I am suggesting, I think, is more open-ended than it is for Fish's Milton. Fish's Milton is, as it were, passive-aggressively trying to coerce us into acknowledging our own place within, you know, fallen nature and fallen society and all those sorts of things. And I mean, as I say, I think Fish misreads Milton in all sorts of interesting ways. But the idea is a sophisticated one, and certainly Shakespeare wants his audiences, not just the ones, you know, with the book open in front of them, but also those in the theatre. He wants them to imagine themselves, you know, in those plays, and through that act of imagination and identification to ask some pretty hard questions about who they think they are, what they think they are, the ways in which they should be behaving, and the ways in which they should be trying to talk about and frame and make sense of their lives. And yes, that is similar, but it's quite different. It doesn't have the kind of, you know, what is that Fish phrase? Communities of interpretation, or whatever it is.
Right.
That kind of social coercion. Shakespeare is much more of an individualist than Fish's Milton.
Okay, fair enough. And I'll go ahead and say, listeners, that Dr. Lewis and I read both Alistair MacIntyre and Stanley Fish differently, and someday perhaps we can get together and battle this out. But today we have but an hour. So I want to turn back to Shakespeare, or at least to Shakespeare as an academic enterprise. I'll confess that the long discussion of crocodiles at the beginning of your Antony and Cleopatra chapter reminded me of my days in the earliest years of the 21st century, studying Shakespeare in graduate school. We're digging into obscure archival materials based on what seems to be a passing reference to aquatic reptiles, but the literary scholar that I'm reading wants me to take Renaissance discourses on crocodiles very seriously indeed. Rodri, make the case for this scrutiny of crocodiles to someone who remembers the new historicist readings with more fatigue than affection.
That's very funny. No, I mean, I share your pain. I lived through it too. You know, we all survived. No, I mean, I suppose, what do I have to say about that? I suppose I'm guilty in some measure, so I'll put that out there. But I do think it's more than just sort of, you know.
By the way, listeners, most of the book he doesn't do that. It's just the crocodiles that he gets fixated on.
It's a fascinating scene in Antony and Cleopatra. I mean, Shakespeare follows his source in Plutarch very, very closely most of the time. But in this scene, which is on Pompey's galley, which is, you know, moored off the coast of Italy, where Antony and Octavius and Lepidus and Pompey are all together on this boat, this is all Shakespeare's invention. So this is all. So it's particular to him, and we have this 20-line conversation. Drunken guy called Lepidus asks Antony about crocodiles, and Antony is really cross about this because he's trying to pretend that he's not really into Cleopatra and that he's really a Roman, and that you know none of this nonsense should matter. So this exchange about crocodiles goes on. Crocodiles are interesting because, you know, if you're a Roman imperialist, as it were, who likes bringing back trophies, you don't want to bring back a crocodile for obvious reasons, and so no one's really seen them. Even Octavius and Lepidus, who are big guys in the Roman world, they don't know what a crocodile is, so they actually quite enjoy the, you know, the sort of exotic travel reportage that Antony might be able to offer. Antony doesn't bother doing that. He just goes through the motions in a very dismissive way. I became interested in the idea of the crocodile as sort of an emblem of Egypt, if that makes sense, which is to say, actually, the Romans aren't that interested in Egypt either as something different. They're only interested in it as something that can be made to make sense within their stories of empire, within the stories they tell themselves about the reasons they are acquiring an empire and such like. So I thought that, you know, and Cleopatra is herself compared to the crocodile at various points within the play. And I thought it was quite a neat way, maybe too neat, of suggesting. I mean, because very often when people talk about Antony and Cleopatra, they imagine, you know, two visions, the luxurious, passionate, sensual East over there. I'm not sure why I'm putting on this movie voice, but anyway. And over there, you know, the Romans, efficient, organized, lethal, very modern, very rational. And these two worlds collide and, you know, Egypt dies beautifully and all the rest of it. And the Romans win. What I suggest, actually, is that what we really see in the play is Egypt being kind of erased, because the Egypt we get is a Roman daydream of Egypt. It's all taken from Ovid. It's all taken from what the Romans imagine it might be like. And so in that respect, it's very much like the crocodile. Because even when they see crocodiles, which they do when they go into Egypt, the Romans don't care. They're not natural historians. They want to see the crocodiles in terms of the monstrous, cunning, evil creatures they have been brought up to believe crocodiles are, rather than what's going on. I think the same is true, basically, of that. So it's a sort of interesting case study in the way in which, you know, certain kinds of imperialism efface that which they are going to take over. And it's a sort of, you know, people perhaps make slightly too much of this in terms of the British imperial thing, because fundamentally in 1606, 1607, Britain was a nobody. You know, there was kind of a couple of failing colonies in Virginia, Massachusetts, daydream. You know, that's it. And Ireland, you know, obviously, fast forward even 60 years, it's a very different story. But then, you know, so either Shakespeare was, you know, prophetic, which I suppose some people believe he was, or he was talking about something else. And I think that is the case. But
very good. In the book's conclusion, you say that in Shakespeare's tragedies, reason is a heuristic. So at the close here, take a moment to say what that means and how it brings together the threads of this conversation.
Yeah, that's a I do say that at the end. I suppose what I mean is, you know, we often talk about the collision between reason and the passions, and how we have to bring our passions under control through our, you know, power of rationality in some sense or another. And what I suppose I was getting at there is that reason, as it's conventionally deployed, which is to say, you know, the word. And how would we parse reason? I mean, you know, our power of thinking intellectually, analytically, making sense of the things, constructing systems of order that enable us to, you know, act in a consistent and ready sort of way. I would say that for, you know, that power is real, but the constellation of senses that gather around the word reason for Shakespeare tend to impose a kind of order and a kind of fixity to those powers of our mind that isn't actually there. So, you know, I could have said placeholder, but I think when I was writing that conclusion, I was addicted to the word heuristic, which is, you know, a thing for thinking with. And I think that's what I'm getting at there. So again, we tend to, I suppose I'm pushing back against the kind of Cartesian sense of ourselves as principally these rational minds who are stuck in these, you know, enfeebled bodies which get in the way, and suggesting that actually for Shakespeare, no, you know, the reason, or the thing we call the reason, is just another one of those parts of us that we don't really understand, that's real, because we have that power, but we don't really understand, and we don't really understand how it connects to everything else. But also, you know, Shakespeare's way of saying that's kind of fine. You know, we don't need to get beaten up over that sort of sense. But yeah,
very good. Well, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation, so in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about Shakespeare, delusion, or whatever else as we head for the door?
big questions. What do I want? I mean, I suppose if I could achieve one thing with this book, it would be to move us on a little bit from the idea that Shakespeare is supposed to be a moral teacher. And I mean, you know, one very often reads, you know, heavily Marxist Shakespeare's, heavily Christian Shakespeare's, heavily Nietzschean Shakespeare's, you know, you pick your heavily Freudian Shakespeare, and everyone wants to, you know, do it their way. And I'm no doubt I'm as guilty as the next person. I've just made him into sort of a dark part of my soul or something like that. But I mean, I think what he's trying to do, rather than teach us, is to give us a space. Tragedy is about, as he writes it, is a way in which we are given the wherewithal, if you like, to recognize that many of the most cherished ideas we have about ourselves and the worlds around us are, in a sense, fictions. You know, heuristics, use a kinder word, approximations, placeholders for any absolute sense. But that actually, as placeholders, fictions, heuristics, representations, to use a different kind of word, are the way in which we have to think about the world, the way in which we, as beings who think through language, are obliged to think about the world, that's sort of okay. And so it's a space in which we can work out, in fact, we're obliged to work out some of that stuff for ourselves, because Shakespeare is not going to give us chapter and verse, or hard doctrine in the way that Milton does sometimes, or the way that his great contemporary Ben Jonson does sometimes. He is going to say, you know, it's on you. You know, you are a moral agent. You know, your agency is not as much as you would like it to be, but you are a moral agent, and you need to figure this out. And I think that's, you know, it's terrifying. And, you know, not always enough to keep you warm at night, as it were. But it's an extraordinary freedom, an extraordinary sort of exhilarating, different way of looking at ourselves and the world around us. And I suppose that's why, I mean, you know, rather than pinning it all on the, you know, the canon or the curriculum or cultural convention or something, that's why we still read him and get a kick. So yeah, that would be my slightly sermonizing, secular sermonizing final message.
Andrew Lewis, thank you for coming on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you so much, Nathan. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is Shakespeare's Tragic Art from Princeton University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack. And I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.